This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Well, I know I already sound really young. People always say, like, you sound like you're 10, and Lisa's 8. So I thought, well, I'll just go a little higher than my natural voice. So this is me, and this is Lisa Simpson.
Right.
It's not that different. We're pretty, pretty close, so.
Hey, guys. Welcome to another episode of the Allison Interviews podcast. So for this season, I really put so much thought into the people I wanted to interview. And one of the things that I had to get done this season was I had to interview somebody from The Simpsons. I was like adamant about it. I'm like, I must interview a cast member from The Simpsons because, first of all, I mean, who isn't obsessed with The Simpsons? It is, I think, the longest running primetime TV series in television history. And then the fact that it's about an animated family, you know, in an animated town. And I mean, it's just, it's such a cultural staple. And the show has brought so many gifts to so many people's lives, just beyond the fact that it makes you laugh out loud. I am a huge fan of anything that makes us laugh out loud, which I'm sure, I mean, who could disagree with that? That's like a, you know, not a controversial statement, right? I mean, who doesn't like to laugh, especially in this day and age? So I was like, yes, I'm like, I will interview a cast member from The Simpsons because they're so brilliantly talented. So I was like over the moon when Yardley Smith agreed to do an interview for my podcast. If you don't know, Yardley Smith has been doing the voice of Lisa Simpson since 1988. I mean, like, that's crazy. So yeah, she is the original and only voice of Lisa Simpson for the past 33 seasons. They're recording season 34 right now, she told me. And hearing her, like, even go into character and go into the voice during the conversation, it was surreal. And I have to say, she is such a lovely, gracious, sweet, kind, compassionate, fun, amazing human being. Like, just absolutely such an amazing woman. We had a great time. She gave me so many insights into behind the scenes, the writer's room, how they come up with their stories and their jokes and how the dynamics and the rhythm of The Simpsons work and the guest stars and how they work on the show. And then just her own personal story, which honestly, she was extremely brave and candid and courageous in sharing a lot of things that she really didn't have to share with me. And I was just so incredibly grateful for that. I mean, when somebody opens up and really bears their soul to me when I'm doing an interview with them, it's such an honor to me that they trusted me to not only hear their story, but then obviously share their story with people who are going to watch and listen. You know, it's an honor. So I just want to go over a few things. So Yardley, in addition to being an icon as an actress and a voice actress and her role on The Simpsons, she also has a podcast called Small Town Dicks. It's super, super cool. So it's this podcast that she co-hosts, and it's about these crazy crimes that take place in small town America. And she actually gets to interview the detectives that help to solve these crimes. And what she said that's really cool about it is she said, you know, these are detectives that are really passionate about their job. They don't just look at it as a job. This is their calling. And there are good cops out there. And that was just a really interesting message that she shared. And the podcast is fascinating. So anywhere you get your podcast, after you listen to this one, of course, listen to Small Town Dicks with Yardley Smith. And Yardley also has this hysterical YouTube and Instagram series called Oil and Water, where she does these really quick cooking and food prep tutorials, and her personality just really shines through on that series. So be sure to catch that. And of course, you have to like binge watch The Simpsons if you've missed any seasons, because season 34 is going to be coming out soon. 34. What the fuck? I'm sorry, but like, that is just beyond impressive. I mean, you got to give them their props. I mean, 34 seasons of an animated sitcom. Unbelievable. So, beautiful people, sit back, relax, and listen to this interview with Miss Yardley Smith.
Allison, it's such a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to meet you, too. It's an honor to meet you. And you know what? It's so funny because this is a weird way to start the interview, but my son, during quarantine in 2020, he's 13 now, but he was 11 or 12 at the time. The way he got through it was by binging The Simpsons from season one, episode one, literally until like season 32 or 33, like every, and he'd come into the kitchen in the morning and be like, I'm on season 11, episode 7.
Wow. That is impressive, because we have well over 700 episodes now. That's commitment. I love that guy. I love that little guy.
That is how he spends his quarantine. So I thank you.
Happy to help.
So let's start at the beginning, because this is just so amazing to me. So when you first got cast as Lisa Simpson, was it 1988 or 1989? And was it for the Tracy Ullman show?
Correct. Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So you get, I'm assuming you had an audition, and was it just described as like, you know, it's for the Tracy Ullman show. It's just going to be like this little cartoon skit thing in between her sketches. Like, how was it pitched to you?
Yeah, sort of, much like that. It was all, I didn't have a voiceover agent at the time. And in fact, the casting director who thought I would be right for Lisa Simpson had actually seen me in a tiny little play in a black box theater in Hollywood the year before. And I was playing a girl who sang Elvis Presley songs and wanted to join the army. So not really anything like Lisa Simpson. But when they were casting The Simpsons on the Tracy Ullman show a year later, she said, I know who should play Lisa Simpson. So they called up my agent, and I was, you know, I'm pretty much still an actor who rarely says no to an audition. But I had zero interest in doing voiceover. You know, I had a very specific plan for world domination, and voiceover was not a part of it. But I remember my agent saying, well, you know, it's James L. Brooks, who, of course, you know, Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart Show and Taxi and a gazillion other films as well. So I went, and they had me read for Bart, which is true. But I feel like now it's become this urban legend, like, oh my God, Yardley was almost Bart. I'm like, no. It sort of overstates the importance of that momentary experiment. It's really only because they have women do the voices of young boys, because our voices don't change.
Right.
So, you know, I was another woman who had an unusual voice, and they were like, oh, well, why don't you read for the brother? And so I did, and it really lasted mere seconds. And then they said, what about Lisa Simpson? And I said, yeah, sure. Why not? I'm a sister. I know about that. But I didn't, having never done voiceover, all my fellow actors have a really big bag of tricks, and I didn't. So I thought, well, I know I already sound really young. People always say, like, you sound like you're 10 and Lisa's 8. So I thought, well, I'll just go a little higher than my natural voice. So this is me and this is Lisa Simpson.
Right.
It's not that different. We're pretty, pretty close. So.
when you were a kid and you were like coming of age, did anyone ever remark to you like, wow, you have a really unusual voice, or like, were you known for your voice?
Yeah, and it was not so kind. It was like, you have a really funny, dumb voice. You have a really stupid voice. You have a really nasally voice. And then they would imitate you. So
right.
I think that really contributed to my notion that I didn't necessarily consider my unusual voice to be such an asset, and that it could be the thing I hung my hat on.
Well, you showed them.
I would say, who has the last laugh now?
Who,
right?
has the last, who looks the fool now? No.
Yeah.
So when you were auditioning, did they put all you guys in a room together? Like, what is it? It's Julie Kavner and who's the
Dan
gentleman
Castellaneta,
who plays
yeah. Dan Castellaneta plays Homer. Nancy plays Bart. Mm-hmm. I'm Lisa, and then Maggie doesn't really talk. And Nancy and I over the years have traded off doing Maggie's sounds. Now Matt did the original sucking of the pacifier sound.
Really?
And he's really good at it. Yeah.
Okay.
And now Nancy obviously couldn't replicate that, but all her sort of coos and gurgles and stuff now is Nancy. But when I auditioned, it was just me. And I remember
they didn't have to see like what the chemistry was, but between the voices.
I honestly think it was really kind of this slapdash idea where James L. Brooks thought, oh, you know, what would be really cool is to have these little cartoon, what we called interstitials, before the commercial break. So we would tell a whole story in like a minute and 20 seconds. So one of the first ones, for instance, was where Bart and Lisa and Maggie are all being put to bed, mm-hmm. and Marge is singing Rockabye Baby to them, which is, when you break it down like that, is a horrible, horrible lullaby. Like, horrible things.
Yes.
The bell breaks, the baby falls. Like,
yes!
How are you going to put your child to sleep to that? So that was one of the first ones we did, I remember. But we had our sound booth was this makeshift space behind the audience bleachers, because Tracy performed in front of a live audience. It was a sketch comedy show, sort of like Saturday Night Live, right? But not on late at night. So they made this booth, wasn't really soundproof at all. We would come in after Tracy and the rest of the cast had their daily rehearsal to mm-hmm. record our part. But Tracy would stay behind and do music rehearsals. And she has an incredible voice. She's got a huge belting voice. And so hilariously, we would be recording and she would be having music practice and we could hear everything. So we have to wait because the sound booth was really not soundproof.
Wow.
And I just don't think, I think obviously the main focus was on the main television show and
sure.
that this was this wild experiment. And so there was no need to do anything like chemistry reads or anything like that. They're like, you know, whatever, it'll be fine.
Well, so, I think what's so cool is, so it's the Fox network,
yes.
which was like I mean, I remember when I was a kid, like that was the network that had all the crazy, wacky, experimental television programming where they were just taking all these risks that the main three or the big three networks would not be willing to take at all. And I think that's what's so beautiful about it, that they even said, okay, now we're going to spin this off into its own show, The Simpsons, and give you guys a primetime slot. I mean, did you think it was going to go? Did you think it would go past the first season at all?
Well, we were what we call a mid-season replacement, for your listeners mm-hmm. who don't know. So we actually, the very first half-hour episode that aired was Christmas 1989, where... In 1989, where we get Santa's Little Helper. It's the Christmas episode, Simpsons roasting on an open fire. And then we had 12 episodes after that for the mid-season replacement starting in January. And I remember the sort of the, because show business is, I would say, so not for the faint of heart. The yes. Not so quiet scuttlebutt behind the scenes was, Fox is crazy. This will never last. Nobody has mm-hmm. put a cartoon on in primetime since the Flintstones. Although I did a podcast recently and somebody corrected me about that. But perhaps the most well-known recent at that time primetime cartoon was the Flintstones.
Okay.
And they were like, you're out of your minds. And they handed James L. Brooks, who said, we will only go to half hour if we get no studio or network notes. And the episodes can be scored by a live orchestra. So every show on television or in film always has a score, right? To sort of mm-hmm. sometimes inform how you should feel about a scene or an interaction or tee you up for something suspenseful. There are any number of ways to do that. And a 40-piece orchestra is, of course, the most expensive. And Fox said, yeah, sure. Partly because I think it's James L. Brooks, and he had such a massive track record. He'd already won Oscars and multiple Emmys. And like, you can have whatever you want. And the PS is, this show isn't going to last past 13 episodes. So you have a good time. And then, of course, it hits so big. So big. So meanwhile, those tenants have remained. We still are scored by a 40-piece orchestra, and we still don't get any studio or network notes. So, you know, as an actor, you're just happy and a show goes past five seasons, because that's the magic number where you have now accrued 100 episodes. 100 episodes means you're going to get residuals for all the reruns that they run. That's like, if you can't get 100, you're not going to be syndicated.
And you've gotten that times seven.
Yes. Yes, we have. We're now in the process of recording season 34, which is just bananas and such a gift. I literally pinch myself every day. I could show you the bruises. it's really, I believe things happen for a reason. You know, I've listened to your podcast, and I join your curiosity in what happens to us after we die, and do we have a purpose? Yeah. And do we have is there a reason for us to be here? And so
Then you won't flip out when I ask those questions, because some people are like they panic when I ask those questions. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm ready for you. I'm ready for it. I'm here for it.
Okay, cool. So what I've always loved about The Simpsons is that the characters kind of give the audience permission to not always be politically correct, to not always be polite, right? It's, it's sort of like, especially I think the Homer character is sort of gives everybody permission to just be, to kind of say and think, you know, and embrace everything that they want to be without any guilt. And then the characters around Homer, like Lisa, is kind of the moral compass of the show, of the family. And it almost reminds me of the model of All in the Family. So you had Archie, who was just like a bull in a china shop. And then you had all these other characters kind of like reining him in. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think, back in the 90s, George H.W. Bush famously said that we need more families like the Waltons and a great many less like the Simpsons.
Okay.
And because of that, because Bart would talk back to his father, and because we were so openly flawed. And I always feel like the thing that H.W. missed about The Simpsons, and if he had truly been a fan, was that they genuinely love each other, and that there is no, first of all, perfection, the pursuit of perfection is a zero-sum game. Nothing will make you less happy than the pursuit of perfection. I speak from experience. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that appearances are more valuable and somehow help society function better, I think is not true. I think that kindness always rules the day, but can't you be yourself and also have empathy and respect for others? So you can still speak your mind, but you don't have to tear somebody down. You can just say, this is why that doesn't work for me. Or here's why I don't agree with you. Or here's my perspective, right? So, you know, we exaggerated on The Simpsons because that's part of what television does, and we are a cartoon.
Yeah.
And for Lisa, you know, I love Lisa Simpson so much. I love her like she is a red-blooded, living, breathing, three-dimensional little girl. I love her. And it has been such a privilege to be a part of her creation, to be the vocal part and sort of the heart and the soul, at least to interpret the words that are given to me on the page and be able to infuse them with my own experience and my heart and my soul. And I feel like Lisa Simpson is also deeply flawed, but what's great about her, what I really aspire to and try to learn from her every time, is that at the end of every episode, when she's gone through the personally often painful journey, because that's the storylines they always give to Lisa Simpson, sometimes to Bart, and they're magic. They're always magic. You know, I think as human beings, we long for personal stories that reflect our own experiences.
Absolutely.
So to see Lisa Simpson come out the other side and kind of go hit the reset button in a way where she's moved the needle a little bit, but most importantly, she doesn't plummet into this shame spiral. She like takes stock of what she learned and sort of goes, okay, well, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. And I, just because things didn't go the way I planned doesn't mean that I have to somehow pay the price for that forever and ever. They just didn't go as planned. So what did I learn from that? And where can I take that knowledge and what's next? I just love that about her. She has a resilience
She's a resilient little creature. I was just going to say that. How much creative input, if any, have you had over the years with her?
It's funny, you know, I went to visit their writer's room just to see, because I admire them so much. And there's always two writer's rooms going at once. And so I asked, can I come and sit in? And they were like, yes, of course. So I went and sat down, and I could hear before I got into the room, the door was closed. I could hear laughter and lots of conversation. And I walked in, and everything just went, and they all just went.
They kind of closed up. Yeah.
Yes. And I thought, no, I'm not here to judge you. I'm here to admire you. I just want to see how you do your thing. So I sat there for about 10 minutes, clearly not going to work. And so I respectfully excused myself. So the only thing I will say is that the writers themselves have said that they work out all of their own childhood angst through Lisa Simpson.
Interesting.
It's so interesting because most of them are men. Hmm. We now have several more female writers on staff, but for years, for the first 20 plus years, we had one female writer.
Get out.
Yeah.
What was it, just coincidence? Like just kind of the
I don't
way
think
it...
so.
Really? Okay. So
I think
what was the fear? What was the reservation, do you think?
You know, I think I don't know, to be honest. My speculation is that in a job like that, and certainly in Hollywood, it's well known that you get a lot of jobs through your connections. So if there was a writer who was really good and valuable to the show, be like, oh, hey, yeah, I know a dude and he works on this show, or he just came off of Letterman, or he came off of SNL. You know, they would kind of pull from many of the same pools that the original writing staff had been formed from. And so I mean, we laugh. I think in some ways it was intentional, but I'm happy now, at least, that they've made a really concerted effort to get some fantastic female writers. And it makes a difference. I mean, it makes a difference to have writers from different cultures. It makes a
difference
because you get just a totally different worldview. So that being said, even when it was mostly men, they, I believe, were always the smartest guy in the room when they were growing up, which when you're a kid, no matter if you do something well, whether it's math or sports or science, acting, whatever it is that sets you apart from your peer group, now you're different. And there's a certain kind of social navigation that goes along with that blessed burden. And so,
well, that's what's so interesting about the show is that it takes a lot of intelligent people to write characters that can sometimes come off as unconscious. Do you know what I mean?
That's well said.
That's the interesting part. Yeah, a very interesting part about it. What are your thoughts, or what I should say, what were your thoughts when you and the rest of the cast came to the realization that, oh, these characters are never going to age. They're going to be forever the ages that they started at.
It was so smart. I knew right then, like, this is genius, because one of the problems always, or one of the conundrums when you're dealing with actual real children on a live action show, is they grow up.
Yeah.
So is the audience willing to grow up with them? Are they willing to make that transition through whatever those awkward stages are, depending on how young you got those kids? So for The Simpsons to be frozen in time, I always say that I feel like it's part of the success of the show is that we remain frozen in time, and it gives us this really solid platform, this kind of constant from which to comment on everything that's going on in the world and current events. So it remains that I was liken it to whenever I travel, I would always, if I was in a hotel room in a place that I was unfamiliar with, a city I'd never been to, I would find Law and Order on TV because you're like, oh, you know, because you know exactly how it's going to go.
Yeah, dun dun.
Yeah. I know the formula. I know we're going to get the bad guy. And there's great comfort in that. And so I think that the Simpsons never aging provides a similar kind of familiarity that makes the show really successful.
100%. I remember thinking, like, that was a brilliant and bold move. And it was a very successful chess move, because that way the kids are not going to age out. The parents are not going to age out. And it's so true. It's frozen in time. So I watched it, and then my son watched it, and we both had the same experience.
Yes. So we are so multi-generational now. We literally have writers on staff who grew up watching the show, who thought, oh my God, wouldn't it be great to work on a show like The Simpsons? I mean, The Simpsons won't still be on, and we're like, yes, we will. Yes, we will. And so you can come right on our show, and then your kids can watch the show. It's pretty extraordinary.
Amazing. And I didn't actually think I was going to ask this, because this was a very recent turn of events. But when I was preparing this morning, I got this thought that came into my head where all of a sudden I thought, wait a second, wasn't Ray Liotta on The Simpsons? Because I was like, I was so devastated to hear about his passing yesterday. And then I don't know why the thought came into my head this morning. I'm like, Ray Liotta was on The Simpsons. And I started Googling it. And then I saw that he played Moe's father, Morty.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. We've had so many incredible guests on. This, the sort of the downside of technology is that now that it's so good, you can actually be anywhere in the world where there's electricity and a pretty quiet room, and we can pick you up and you don't have to be in the room with us. And so for big stars like Ray Liotta and, you know, Meryl Streep, although Meryl Streep actually happened to be in town, although I did not get to record with her. But it, my point being that there are so many stars who have been on The Simpsons, and most of them, we actors don't get to meet. The producers get to meet them. It's so unfair. But I'm with you. I was so deeply saddened. He's so young. And he was such a great actor. I really always enjoyed his work.
Yeah, incredible actor. From what I understand, really sensitive and kind guy.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know. Yeah, that's true. That's one of the downsides. If it was live action, then you would have perhaps spent some time with him. But but did you ever see those episodes at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually still watch the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you happen to see his performance as, I guess it was Morty. It was Moe's dad.
Yeah, he played Moe's dad. And I always listen for when we have big celebrities. I'm always impressed when a celebrity can fit into the world. You know, The Simpsons, we have a very specific sound. There's a subtle rhythm to the way conversations are held by the characters in the show. And some even phenomenal actors it's really quite funny. It's quite sweet, really, if they do come and record with us. And, you know, they've won Oscars and maybe they've won Tonys and Emmys and you name it. And they get to us and they're like, what do I do? And you're like, you do what you do. And sometimes the celebrity really sticks out like a sore thumb. You can go, oh, they're not really part of Springfield, but it's fun to hear them anyway. But Ray Liotta, absolutely seamless. Seamless in the way that, for instance, Joe Mantegna plays Fat Tony, absolutely seamless. Meryl Streep was seamless. Dustin Hoffman was seamless. Ricky Gervais, seamless. Like, it's just really, really fun when it works. It's really fun.
Who is your favorite, big celebrity who came to Springfield of all time? Is there a favorite?
Well, I have to say it was pretty amazing to meet Lady Gaga.
Okay.
That was pretty extraordinary.
Did you record with her?
Yes.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes. She came to the studio. I got to stand next to her. It was that just was amazing. Like, amazing. And she was so game. She was so willing. Like, we do every scene 4 times. Mm-hmm. And then if the writer producer still doesn't have exactly what they want, we'll then pick up lines individually to complete that scene and move on to the next. So it can feel tedious, I think, if that's not your process, if you're not used to that. But certainly for a celebrity, for instance, we do it as the regular actors, we do a ton of ADR, which means for your listeners, like if they do a rewrite over the course of the 8 to 9 months of animation for one show, there are multiple rewrites. Mm-hmm. I will come in and redo a line because the original didn't quite hit the way they wanted to or whatever the case may be. So I do a lot of that. But if you're Lady Gaga and your schedule is packed from noon to night for the next 3 years, we're probably not going to get you to come. We're not going to have an opportunity for you to come and do ADR. So we really, really need those 4 different takes.
Okay.
And she was so gracious and kind and humble and beautiful. I just so enjoyed that. That was amazing. I also, very early on in the series, season 2, I believe it was flown to New York to record with Dustin Hoffman, who played Lisa Simpson's substitute teacher. It's a great episode. Just sort of a running list of top 10 of favorites. It always makes it. It's called Lisa's Substitute, and he's brilliant in it. And that was a really one of the best days of my acting career. It was so deep. It was so meaningful. It was just extraordinary. It was kind of like, is this happening? Am I really here? It was great.
Well, you know, what's funny is that all of those people were probably thinking, is this happening? Am I really here?
You're so
That's
sweet.
The funny part.
I hope so. I sure hope so.
How do you think, or what do you think about the way The Simpsons handles politics, social issues, and perhaps some heavier social and political issues?
You know, I feel like on our show, we take no prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, nobody is safe. And I know personally that their politics are, for the most part, you know, I guess what would be considered democratic, right? Like, listen, live and be well. Can everybody have the same human rights, the same basic rights? Can we all just, you know, get along and try to respect each other and have empathy for our different experiences? And so when we do commentary on current events or something political, and there's always satire, we will take it certainly to the edge, partly because, again, we're a cartoon. That's part of what is afforded to you, I think, mm-hmm. because we're bright yellow and we have 4 fingers and, you know, this massive overbite every character had. Like, we're no lookers, I can tell you that. We're not a beautiful bunch. That it kind of affords you a little more attitude in terms of having a more biting commentary. So I can't say that we always get it right, but I do know that the writers' hearts are always in the right place. I know also because I'm friends with several of them, as with all of us, the news of the world, certainly in the last several years, weighs heavily on them. And it can be really difficult to have to write comedy, to write a show in some ways that just sort of marches on without necessarily a nod to what's happening, like what happened this week with the school shooting and the grocery shooting, what happened, you know, the war in Ukraine. Is it okay to still write comedy? Does that feel morally irresponsible? And I think you could look at it both ways, that in order for us to be able to cope with this extraordinarily heavy time in our country's history, you need things to also lighten the load. Like, I do a cooking show on Instagram and YouTube called Oil and Water Stupid Good, and I cook a whole recipe in like 6 minutes. And I do take actual recipes. So if you look those recipes up, you could cook from them too, but it's not a cooking show sort of like Giada De Laurentiis does. But really, I started it in the pandemic because for me, there was value in having dumb entertainment for troubling times. Like, there has to be a way, right, to offload that kind of anxiety and stress that feels constant.
Yeah. And by the way, I watched a couple of episodes of the cooking show. Yeah. So it's Oil and Water with Yardley Smith, and it's on YouTube and then your Instagram as well.
It's actually on Oil and Water Food on Instagram.
Okay.
has its own channel. And then, so Oil and Water originally started out as a game where I would take two ingredients that would never go together and make them into a third thing that I would draw randomly from a bowl. And then I just got tired of putting sardines in my ice cream. So I was like, you know what? I'm actually a pretty good cook. Let me start cooking from all these amazing, mostly internet chefs who are home chefs, who have their own food blogs, who are making incredible food in their kitchens. I'm like, I want to eat that stuff. Let's make it and see if it's not only good, but stupid good.
Yeah. And you're so like, to me, the main draw was your personality. Your personality really shines.
Thank you. That is sort of, as I say, if you're going to try to cook an entire dish in 6.5 minutes, you're probably not going to get a lot of instruction. Although I always go over the hard things. And listen, I've had some failures, but I always feel like there's a way to, as the saying goes, make lemonade out of lemons. So
absolutely. So what's like the craziest recipe that you've tackled so far? Or unlikeliest recipe?
Yeah, on Oil and Water, it was a Halloween-themed episode where we had predetermined that the thing, so you get a sweet, savory thing, right? So pull from a bowl of sweet ingredients, bowl of savory ingredients, bowl of things, like it's a pie, it's an ice cream, it's a soup, it's a casserole, blah, blah, blah. We had predetermined that the thing was going to be a candy apple because it's Halloween. That was the only thing we knew. From the bowl of sweet, I drew Skittles because it had to be all Halloween candy. And from the bowl of salmon, of savory, I drew salmon roe because all of the ingredients were orange colored.
Okay.
Allison, when I tell you it was the most disgusting thing I have ever eaten in my life, because of course you have to taste it. That's part of the game.
Of course.
Oh my God. Oh, it was so bad, we had to set it on fire. Literally set it on fire. It was horrific. So yeah, that was the worst. I did. And then on Stupid Good, I mean, I recently made a Swiss roll, which is basically, you know, chocolate cake rolled up with usually a cream filling. It's very reminiscent of a ho-ho or a Little Debbie, depending on which wherever part of the country you grew up in.
Yeah.
And absolute visual disaster. Oh my God, it could not have been worse. However, it was damn tasty. Yeah. And so I decided, all right, well, I'm not going to throw out these delicious now shards of chocolate cake and this beautiful softly whipped cream that's vanilla flavored. I'm going to put it in a martini glass and make a parfait.
Nice.
Nobody will be the wiser.
Yeah. Nice. So, that reminds me, like, I made I watched on YouTube one time, this girl, her name's Jessica Kent. She made a prison cake. She's like, she did time in prison. And she's like, this is how we made, what was it? Like a fudge cake in prison. And you take all these ingredients that you could get from the prison commentary, and you chop up the Oreos, and you take like coffee creamer and peanut butter, and you make the topping, and you throw some M&Ms on top of it. I mean, it looked disgusting, but when I tell you how freaking good it was, I mean, I was like,
that is fantastic. Oh my God. What's her name? Jessica Kent?
Jessica Kent. And if you look up how to make, I don't know what it was, a prison cake, prison cake.
I mean, how many entries for that could there be? So
right.
I love that. I mean, and the point is, and what I love what you just described and sort of what I was trying to get across in my repurposing my failed Swiss roll was recipes should be a template, right? If you are making something, and then at the bottom of a good recipe, it'll always say adjust to taste. So that means you like a little, you want it to be, ooh, a little more tart, add some, you know, acid to it, like lime or lemon, or a little sweeter or less sweet, or you want a little more peanut butter or whatever it is. The recipe is just a guide. And while baking is actually science, and there are some things that you kind of have to do in a certain order, at the end of the day, if you're frosting a cake and you want it to have more vanilla, add more vanilla. There is, you know, no hard and fast rule, but I think people who don't cook a lot feel like, oh God, I have to follow the recipe to the letter. That's not true. Not true. You do you. That's the best way.
And by the way, that advice applies to life.
Yes, it does.
That is great advice. So before we get to like some of the spiritual stuff, I want to ask you about Small Town Dicks, which is your podcast that you co-host. Have you always been a true crime buff?
Yes. Yes. I grew up always wanting the good guys to win. And, you know, I feel like it's so important that we're having this really worthy and hopefully productive conversation about how policing can improve in America. I think sitting next to that is absolutely a space for, here's also some these cases that are being solved by cops who are really doing the job the right way, who care deeply, who consider policing to be a calling and not just a job, who don't believe that the person who committed the crime is, for the most part, is a bad person. They just made a bunch of bad decisions, right? Yeah. So Small Town Dicks, I co-host with identical twin detectives, Dan and Dave. And all of the stories are told by the detectives who investigated the case. So my role in the trio is I'm you. So if you had the privilege to sit at that table and ask any question you wanted, no question is off limits, then that's what I aim to do. Also clarifying things, you know, there's a heck of a lot of acronyms in policing. So I'm like, what's that? The what? But I also, as you know, I think you would resonate with this. I want to know how you solve the case. But then I also want to know, where does that kind of work live inside of you? If basically your whole job is by and large encountering somebody on their worst day, and you're supposed to help make that better or de-escalate the situation or make sure the public is safe, or, and the list goes on. Where does it go when you then have to go home and be a husband, a father, a mother, a wife, a sister? Like, how does it live inside you? Because that amount of stress on a daily basis is just not normal. So how do you cope with it? And really the answer we get 99% of the time is, well, you know, you get pretty good at putting it away in a box. You just sort of lock it away. It has its own spot. And then a few minutes later, they'll tell you, the trouble is the lock on the box isn't that good. And so there's ultimately a toll for everything that you refuse to deal with, which again goes back to life in general. Like if you have a tremendous loss and you bottle up that grief and that anger and the anxiety and the confusion, whatever that cascade of emotions is, that bottle is not going to stay sealed forever. It's just not. It's going to bleed out and you're going to perhaps get poor health. It'll affect your relationships. It'll affect mm-hmm. your desire to get out of bed. I mean, I'm sure you know all this. It's, you know, the list goes on. So I'm always fascinated by that.
I think that, well, I've come up with a theory, and it is kind of a gender-based theory, although, yes, there are exceptions to the rule, that I feel like a man's mind, you know, I'm talking mainly the male way of coping, that a man's mind, it's kind of like a house with multiple floors and there's an attic, and they put all their bad stuff in the attic and they lock the door and they like go and hang out in the living room downstairs. Right.
Yes.
And then sometimes they'll like peek up into the attic and open the door, and then it kind of hits them like an avalanche. Whereas women, we live in like a big open loft where we experience everything. Like it permeates our whole being. We don't shove it somewhere. You know, we're experiencing all of it, but I almost feel like in a lot of ways we have the better deal because we, at least if you're more empathic, like you experience it, you feel it, you live it, you process it, and then you don't forget it, but you're able to move forward like in a healthy, productive way.
I totally agree. That's a really fantastic analogy. I love the visuals of it. I would add to that they lock the door of the attic, but the thing is there's a little crack at the bottom of the door, and that stuff, if the longer you wait to open that door, it'll start to leak out under the door. And then it'll find its way down the stairs. It will get you.
It'll trickle down the stairs. Yeah. But
it will find you. 100%.
Yeah. I think that paradigm needs to shift a little bit, especially
Absolutely.
If you're dealing with very stressful or work that has a lot of trauma involved in it.
Yes. Remarkable in speaking to these detectives now, where we just are about to wrap up season 10. We do two seasons a year, so we're about almost 5 years old. Mm-hmm. That there isn't more full-throated support for getting these first responders, whether you're dispatch, which is also a massively high-pressure job, firemen, paramedics, police, that there isn't more open support for getting them the mental health care that they could obviously benefit from. You know, there's such a stigma about it, though, that these incredible first responders are really reluctant to reach out and take what probably, at least insurance-wise, is available to them, right? Like, no, you can do it. We have it here. But everyone's like, no, I don't need that. No, unless absolutely mandated to do so. So that culture, I think, really needs to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you ever go into this on the podcast, but I know that for a very long time, and I don't know if it still goes on, that police would drown their sorrows in alcohol and drugs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because they just didn't know how to push it out of their mind, whether it's seeing a victim, you know, or like you said, whether it's dealing with people on their absolute worst day.
Absolutely. There's a quite high rate of law enforcement suicide after mm-hmm. retirement. But you're absolutely right also about the alcohol, you know, which bleeds into failed relationships and a kind of a wound tightness that is so heartbreaking. And because they really had their heart and their souls in this incredibly high stress job that they felt was a calling. And now once the job is over, or even if they're still in the middle of it, they feel like they're left perhaps, or I'm going to say, it seems as though they're left holding the bag without any place mm-hmm. to offload it. And at a certain point, I think you get into diminishing returns and you won't get the best work out of those people because they're saddled with so much, right? All of this, I'm in many cases, it would be medically classified as PTSD. So I just feel like it saddens me that they don't feel as though they can take advantage of the resources that might be offered to them because it's so stigmatizing. And right. It's ridiculous. Like, for good God. I mean, if you, I just can't even, you know, giving somebody a death notification to tell them that their child is dead, that their loved one is dead, to say, to do CPR on an infant and it doesn't work. Like, are you kidding me?
And these are all these are all stories that you've heard on the podcast when you're speaking to these detectives.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
It's really, really well done, I must say, even if I wasn't a part of it. It's very reverent toward the victims and it's very respectful. And also we've done cases about bad cops as well. So while one would certainly consider it a pro-police podcast, I feel like it's also really balanced and measured and thoughtful and intelligent. So if you haven't heard it, give it a go.
Okay. And what is the best advice that you have ever received?
Well, I guess two things. The first thing that comes to mind, though I remember feeling like it was cold comfort at the time, my father, who I was not particularly close to, said, "This too shall pass." And I remember thinking like, really? That's all you got? That's all you got for me right now? And I can't remember what it was, but clearly my heart was broken or I was terribly upset about something. And that's all he had to offer. It turned out to be true. But at the time it was like, ugh. But the other thing I think, which stuck with me and also is really valuable, is be on time. Don't ever consider that your time, no matter where you are in the food chain, is more valuable than somebody else's. And so get it together and be on time. Now, sometimes, of course, the world intervenes, but by and large, make an effort.
But have the intention.
Yes.
And what is something about yourself that continues to be a work in progress?
Oh, Allison. I think
I'll go first if you want. No, you can go first.
I feel like the list is so long. That's the groan. I will say the thing that I have struggled with all my life, and it's certainly better now, but that there will be times in my life when I'm under a lot of stress where it will grab me by the throat again, and that is the pursuit of perfection. And I mentioned it early in the conversation that it really perfection, the pursuit of perfection is a zero-sum game because you will never achieve it and therefore you will never feel satisfied with your pursuit or what you actually achieve, like the thing that you got. And so what's that expression? Perfection is the enemy of good. And I remember when I first heard that, I thought, that is bullshit. What are you talking about? Oh my God, that you would settle for good. But what it does, once I was sort of able to really tease it apart and understand it on a deeper level, perfection is the enemy of good, is that there is such a thing as recognizing that you gave the relationship, the work product, the personal pursuit, everything you had. And the result of that is exactly what it needed to be. And for you to stay stuck trying to make it into something that you perceive as perfect is only going to keep you where you are, and you won't be allowed to go forward and evolve and move on to something else and continue to grow and learn. And it will foster a misery that is unlike anything else. And so that is a thing that I really struggle with. It really, really shows up in my body image. You know, I had an eating disorder for 24 years.
24 years in recent times, in, you know, many years
from
ago?
The time I was 14 till 39.
So my gosh.
I'm 57 now. I always say, hey, listen, what? I'm not a quitter. So, but it was, and still, even though I went to an outpatient program at UCLA for 13 months. We met 8 hours a week. And essentially it was group therapy for people who had eating disorders. It happened to be all women at the time, but that wasn't the mandate. It just happened to be that. And one of the things we had to do was eat a meal together, which of course is harrowing if you have an eating disorder. My particular predilection was bulimia. And the other thing we had to do, which was also harrowing, was we had to do something social. Every week you had to make a social commitment because eating disorders are incredibly isolating. And you practice your disorder in private. It's very ritualistic. It's very secret. And it's not social like drinking. Not to say that one is worse than the other, just different and different sort of MOs. So I remember being 39 and thinking like, okay, and I'd been in therapy many years by then. And I would just lie by omission, depending on how it struck me, how I wanted to report on my eating disorder at the time. And I remember thinking, I can't turn 40 and still be binging and puking my brains out. I can't. So I sort of pulled up my socks and said, all right, I need some actual help. I've been telling myself that I can do this on my own forever and ever. And obviously I can't, so I need some help. And that's when I went to that program and I got a bunch of tools. And then it was probably another couple or 3 years before I really was not afraid of food. Mm-hmm. So now I feel like the food is actually good. Like I don't have I'm not afraid of food. There are a couple of trigger foods that I really stay away from.
Would you say that the treatment was for the most part effective?
Yes, but it's kind of like, in 12-step programs, there's that saying, it works if you work it, I believe, some version of that. And so for this program, I was given all these tools, but they're absolutely useless if you don't actually apply them, right?
Like anything else, yeah.
Like anything, which is why it took another probably almost 3 years for me to really kind of normalize my eating to not, that after the program, I could go 6 weeks, maybe 2 months without binging and purging. And then I would have a spate of binging and purging. And then I would back on track.
I just want to understand, just because I'm a little ignorant about that. Is it a feeling that you don't deserve to nourish your body, or is it a fear that food will put weight on, or what is the fear exactly?
Yeah, the fear is that you do deserve nothing good.
Okay.
The fear is rooted in a deep shame of who you are, how much you have not lived up to your expectations or other people's, that your body isn't the shape and size that it should be, that you see in the magazines, that I see in my industry. It is really a punishment. And then this twisted, ironic way that by binging and purging, you like, listen to me, I have control over you. When in fact, what you're doing is completely out of control. So it's this false sense of, I can fix this, but there's so much anxiety and pain in feeling like you're never enough and that you're not good enough and you haven't achieved enough and you're unworthy of everything from love to the good things that happen to you, that there's so much grief there that doing this violence to your body is sort of like a drug, right? It distracts you from those feelings that are so hard to sit with. Because it's literally, there's an actual activity in eating all that food and then making yourself vomit.
Have you found a peace? Have you found a feeling of, I guess, self-love or at least self-like at this point?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. You know, and again, it kind of comes in fits and starts. I admit, I'll read about a celebrity who, whose super famous and used to not like herself. And then she, I don't know what she did, but now she loves her. I'm like, how the fuck did you get there? Like, how did that happen? I don't know. I'm like, I read so many books. I've done so many things. And it kind of goes back to your conversation with Randy Spelling, where he talks about when he was doing drugs and drinking, and obviously, and all anything and everything that you could do to fill up the inside from the outside.
Right.
And I did a one woman show off Broadway back in 2006 called More. And the tagline was, you can't fill up the inside from the outside. And it really was 90 minutes of all these ways I chronicled of, despite my really pretty great success, it felt like it was never enough, because I was looking like, maybe if I'm famous, I'll feel full, I'll feel worthy, I'll feel beautiful, I'll feel like everything I have, I deserve. Maybe if I have enough money and I can, you know, have a beautiful house, I'll feel content. Maybe if I have a husband, blah, 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 the list is endless. So I am definitely better, but I really, for any woman out there, so like I said, I'm 57. And for any woman out there who feels like I should know these things by now, I should feel this well of self-love by now. How come I don't? What's wrong with me? Nothing is wrong with you. And I'm in the same boat, and I have the same questions. Right. And I believe that if you didn't get those tools early in life, it's just going to take a little longer and it's going to be a little harder.
I always say that for me anyway, and I don't think I'm alone, that my parents raised me as well as they could, and then I had to re-raise myself.
That's really okay? Well said.
So, and for me, for whatever it's worth, what I found was getting into spirituality and uncovering the mystery of who we really are at our core, at our essence, is what created that feeling of self-love. It wasn't just like being a person, you know what I mean? I had to figure out like who I really was, because being a person never quite felt like enough. And I always felt like something, it's like there's a puzzle piece missing here. Something's off. And when I realized that we actually are spiritual beings, and there's so much more to the picture than what we can experience with our five senses, you know, we come here with like a kind of an amnesia. Because, you know, we're here to grow and expand and learn certain things. And I feel like what people consider success on the physical plane is not necessarily so. Not that the material type of success isn't great and fun and wonderful, but for somebody, success might be that they simply came into this life to learn self-love. And even if they never made a fortune, even if people don't know their name, even if they're not physically what society would consider beautiful, if they mastered self-love in that lifetime, then their soul achieved what it came here to achieve. They are a massive success.
Totally agree. Example,
right?
Yeah.
So
totally agree.
Yeah. So that's why success is, there's more to it than what people realize, you know. Even like somebody might have come into this life and agreed and said, okay, I'm going to come in a state of poverty, and I'm going to learn how to take care of myself and become self-sufficient. And even if that means making minimum wage, for their soul, they accomplished what they came here to accomplish.
Yeah.
Right. So you can't really compare yourself to this one, that one, because you don't know why they're here.
Right. And there's that expression, compare and despair.
Right.
Right. To hold yourself up against somebody else's journey or the things that they have and wonder why you're not like that or why you don't have those things is only going to lead to a kind of misery you don't want to get near.
Yeah. And that's why, even like with our social media existence now, anytime I catch myself having that thought, I say, stop, wait. Allison, why are you here? It has nothing to do with why they're here. Like, don't You know what I mean? Just refocus, and it works. It works.
Fantastic. It truly, truly does. I'm going to borrow that.
Borrow it, please, by all means. And that brings me to the question that I know that you're probably waiting for, which is, what do you think you came into this life as Yardley Smith to learn? And what do you think you came here to teach?
I think I knew you were going to ask this because I've listened to your pod. I do think a lot of it has to do with recognizing the personal and valuing the personal internal victories, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the external, the very flashy, you know, the Lisa Simpson. I've had the great good fortune to have a good on-camera career, you know, won an Emmy, blah, 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 all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think, but the valuing of my heart and soul and what I have to bring to the world by being kind and compassionate and generous is, I believe, the lesson for that to feel like enough. That mm-hmm. I believe is a lot of what I'm here to learn. I feel like if you can get to that place, it leads to a quiet kind of leadership that can really help get things done, that can motivate. Like, I have a company that I co-founded with my longtime business partner, Ben Cornwell, and we had this production and development company called Paperclip Limited. And now we have 4 people that work for us. Then we have a whole separate podcast team, right? We have 2 editors and another producer and stuff. So all told, there's probably a dozen people under the Paperclip umbrella. And I consider myself a reluctant leader. It's never mm-hmm. the place I ever wanted to. I wasn't like, oh, I can't wait to lead a company. I'm like, oh my God, the heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Yeah.
but I feel like the part of that job that I enjoy and that I want to really feel like is valuable is the way that I lead. So with a really collaborative spirit, is there an issue? Let me help you solve it. I don't want to shut you down, right? Mm-hmm. These things are important. I'm here to hope that you have a great time working here, but also help you get where you need to go, wherever that may be. I'm in a position to do so. So I really enjoy that, but sometimes I very much feel like that's not enough, or maybe that doesn't count, or I too get caught up in the, you know, you're really not that famous, Yardley. And this business is happy to reinforce that. So part of my journey, I feel like, is to tune all that out and listen to my own voice and value things that I wasn't necessarily brought up to value. And I think if you're aware of the things that you're learning yourself, those are the things that you're most able to teach. And so, yes. Right? So I feel like all I can do is lead by example. That's what I think I'm here to teach.
And by the way, I love how you said, I want an Emmy, blah, blah, blah. That's come on now. Like, seriously?
It used to be a doorstop. I used to use it as a doorstop. The fucking thing is heavy and it's dangerous. It's a great doorstop.
Oh, Lord. Don't piss you off.
That's right. That's right.
Well, actually, I want to add a little bit something onto that question, since you're in a very unique position. What do you think the character of Lisa Simpson has taught people? Millions and millions of people.
Yeah. I mean, that little girl, so much, so, so much. I think, you know, one of the best things about Lisa Simpson is her genuine, unbridled optimism. The joke is always whatever they give to Lisa Simpson at the beginning of an episode, 22 minutes later, they've taken it away. Whether it's an award, a friend, a point of view. And yet she never, ever, ever gives up. She pulls up her socks. She finds comfort in her family, usually, which is beautiful if you're lucky enough to have that. If not, mm-hmm. you know, a close friend or something. So I was once asked by a therapist, how do you soothe yourself? And or how did you soothe yourself as a child mm-hmm. when you were upset? And I couldn't answer the question. I couldn't remember. I couldn't point to one thing. And I feel like Lisa Simpson is really brilliant at being able to soothe herself with simple things that is usually, you know, making up with whoever if there was a source of anxiety with another character outside of her family, she kind of comes to a truce with it. Like Nelson, when there's that great episode where Lisa and Nelson get together, they mm-hmm. realize they're not going to be a good couple, but you know what? They could actually still be really good friends.
yeah.
Sideshow Bob, who is everybody's nemesis, she recognizes the genius in him. They become friends, but he can't sustain it. She's like, you know what? I still really enjoyed our time together. So Lisa Simpson's optimism and resilience, I think, is something that we can all learn from just by example. Like, she doesn't dwell on the things that didn't work. I think she mm-hmm. learns from them, but she doesn't sort of pack them in like, oh my God, this is my penance. She just like, okay, all right, I get it. All right, moving on. What's next? I love her. Love her.
Love that. Love that. So when does season 34 of The Simpsons come out?
It will come out in September. So we start recording in March because it takes mm-hmm. so long to animate one episode. So we're like six episodes in, but yeah, we're still on the old school television schedule where shows start in September and they end in May, sort of like the school year. We're one of the last holdovers. So
yeah. And you only get to see one a week, right? No binging. Yep. Yeah.
No binging, unless you want to watch old episodes. And then if you go to Disney Plus, because Disney bought The Simpsons about 3 years ago, there's a Simpsons tile, like we have our own tile. And they've done this beautiful job of curating them into categories. Like, you can watch all the Treehouse of Horror Halloween episodes. You can watch, you know, all the Lisa Homer episodes. You can watch, it's great.
Oh, I love that.
Yes. Oh, kind of like a little filing cabinet for episodes.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. And okay, so Small Town Dicks, your podcast, the true crime podcast, that's available wherever people listen to
Absolutely.
Their podcast.
Wherever you Google Play, Amazon, iTunes, Spotify. And also, I will say, just to promote our Patreon page. So if you go to Small Town Dicks, or if you go to patreon.com, Small Town Dicks podcast. So $5 a month, and we curate special content every week. And we just started a new limited series there in January called The Briefing Room, where mm-hmm. Dan and Dave talk about current events, about some of the case law that law enforcement has to abide by in order to do their job. Absolutely fascinating. So informative. Okay. It is. Dave gives his, because Dave investigated sex crimes and child abuse when he was a detective, gives his presentation on how kids need to stay safe online, the kinds of grooming techniques to look out for. It's really, really well done.
Wow. Interesting. I was a criminal justice major. I'm like,
were you?
Rubbing my hands together here. Yeah. That is so interesting.
That's
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. They were the only classes I didn't skip. I didn't cut. True story. okay. And Oil and Water with Yardley Smith. So that is, you can find that on YouTube. And what's the handle for the Instagram again?
It's Oil and Water Food. Okay. On Instagram and YouTube, I believe. But if you, my mug will pop up, my face will pop up with all kinds of tiles and episodes, and I think you'll really enjoy it. It's a great little break from, you know, what most of us are dealing with on the day to day. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're honestly, like, your personality, I don't know what it's doing for you, but it cheers me up. I mean,
I love you. Thank you.
And I just want to say thank you because you were even more open and giving than I could have even expected. And I truly appreciate and honor your story. And I really thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Allison. I'm grateful to be given the opportunity to sit down with you. I really never take these kinds of conversations for granted. And so I'm deeply grateful as well.
Oh, thank you, Yardley.
Hey guys, so what did you think? Were you not floored by Yardley's candor and just her emotional accessibility and just what a sweet, amazing, like I just want to hug her and like pinch her cheeks. She's just so awesome. I had the best time with her. I now kind of like consider her a friend. I mean, she's just such a sweet woman. My God. And I am so happy for her success. I mean, it's unbelievable. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Yardley Smith and look forward to season 34 of The Simpsons, which will be coming out probably later this year. If you liked this episode, please subscribe if you're watching it on YouTube. If you are catching it on Apple Podcasts, please leave me a review. Please subscribe to the podcast. If you're listening to it on Spotify, same thing. And I will catch you on the next go-round. Peace, guys.